Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 72, Fort Anne and Harborton. So when last we left off, we found out that Sinclair found himself in a bit of a tough position. The British had pretty much surrounded Fort Ticonderoga, very loosely, but they were prepared to lay siege to it. The biggest problem was the British took the mountain called Sugarloaf, and it could shell the American position with great ease, especially considering Burgoyne had 12 and 24-pound guns available to him. Now, maybe Sinclair's position would have been held a little bit better if Gates had listened to everyone and said, put some troops at the top of Sugarloaf, but he didn't, and so the British hold the mountain. So it's decided that they're going to retreat, they're going to use nightfall as cover, but the retreat is going to be twofold. Supplies, artillery, and invalids, anyone that couldn't march, was going to be loaded up on Benedict Arnold's navy, pretty much the few ships that have survived. Trumbull, Revenge, Enterprise, Royal Savage is destroyed. Who am I thinking of? The Gondola, New York, I think is still functional. But basically, they don't have very many big ships. They're relying on their 200 bateaux to shuttle the troops back and forth from Skanesboro. Now, if you're looking at a map, quick reminder, Skanesboro is now present-day Whitehall, New York. So if you're looking at a map, that's where you need to look for. The main army would march itself with Sinclair to Hubbardton, take a roundabout trip to end up at Skanesboro. From there, they would move on to another position. Even in the darkness, it would be difficult to cover up the sound of men moving supplies and everything, so the Americans thought of a distraction. Sinclair ordered the large guns of the fort to open up once night fell to, you know, keep the British heads down, I guess. The thing about this is, it's a great plan on Sinclair's part. Distract them, think that there's a cannonade, but the problem is that the British have been duped this way before. We've seen it time and time again since 1775. The British underestimate the Americans' ability to escape. And not only in the Northern campaign, but Washington. Howe has made a career in 1 year of chasing Washington from New York City all throughout New Jersey and all the way down into Pennsylvania. You would think that, like, when nightfall hits, we should probably make sure that the Americans aren't running away. But no, once again, the cannons are a distraction, and the British say, oh, they're not hitting anything, they're just wasting ammunition, they're stupid, is the mindset that it's happening, and, well, no, you're just being outsmarted. And so the British just think that they're wasting ammunition. Well, the next day, the British come to find out that the Americans, once again, slipped through their fingers. On a search of the fort, they found it pretty much deserted. Most of the guns and supplies were gone. Burgoyne saw that the fleet is missing. You know, how do you miss an entire fleet? Well, he says, well, I'm going to send my ships and chase the American fleet down. So he prepares to do that. He orders General Fraser, with the support of the Baron von Riedesel, to track down the American army, which is moving over land. Fraser took his light infantry and grenadiers, and he was supported by Riedesel's regiment, Bremen's grenadiers, and light infantry from his regiment. And then the 62nd Regiment of Foot would move into the fort with Prince Frederick's Brunswickers moving to Mount Independence. That in a nutshell, is the entire siege of Ticonderoga. It wasn't a long siege. It wasn't a very decisive siege. It was pretty clear that the Americans weren't going to hold the position, so they moved out. The American army was moving down what we would loosely call a road. It's a wagon cut, a rough road carved out by wagons moving through the area with stumps, intersecting swamps, ponds, streams. I mean, you name it. It's about 20 miles to the town of Hubbardton. When they arrive at the tiny hamlet late in the afternoon, the tiny hamlet, I also should say, was only about two houses. This wasn't a very large area. They get there. Sinclair's like, we're going to rest. We're going to rest at Hubbardton. Then we're going to boogie for Skanesboro. We're going to make this a long march, which was another 10 miles away. The American before the American Army moves out, Sinclair orders that Colonel Seth Warner, yes, the Seth Warner of the Green Mountain Boy fame, with his 150 men, would hold at Hubbardton, wait for the rear guard to arrive, and then move out with them just to make sure that the rear guard was protected from marauding Indians that the British may have. Seth Warner, waiting at Hubbardton, the rear guard arrives. Well, whatever it is about Green Mountain Boys, they are really not followers, and he decides to convince Colonel Francis, the man who is in charge of the rear guard, to hold up with his regiment, the 11th Massachusetts, and Colonel Hale's 2nd New Hampshire. They would camp at Hubbardton for the night and wait for the British. For the British, Fraser was a man that was tired of getting duped by the Americans, especially since the Valcour Island campaign. He was done with it. He says, I'm going to track down the American army if it kills me. And that's what he's going to do. Sinclair left about 2-3 in the morning, made the escape, everything was great. For Fraser, it's figured out very early on that the Americans have escaped. By the time he gets the orders from Burgoyne, it's about 4 a.m. They're going to march till mid-afternoon as well. It takes them a while to do the 10 or 15 miles that it is, but they're within 5 miles of Hubbardton, where he decides to let his men, let the Germans camp. He's going to take his light infantry and grenadiers along with the regiment of irregulars, the Indians, Tories, and Canadians. And he's going to just go a little bit farther, and he brings the Baron von Riedesel with him. They're going to go a little bit farther, and they're going to just see if they're nearby. So they get within a few miles of Hubbardton. Fraser says, I'm going to start off at 3 a.m. to make sure that I close some distance before the American army starts marching for the day. Great move, and it actually works, except Seth Warner wasn't planning to move out, at least very quickly. He was going to wait until at least halfway through the morning before he started heading south to catch up with the main American force under Sinclair. They figured out that the Americans are camping at Hubbardton, but they have no pickets. And so the Indians that are with Fraser, a couple of their scouts, report back, well, there's an opening here. So that's what Fraser does. He marches his men through that opening. 750 men will descend upon the New Hampshire men, catching them completely off guard and sending them running for the woods. Warner and Francis, who only have minutes to answer this attack, put themselves onto two small pieces of high ground. This high ground would be very beneficial to them. You see, the woods in the area were a tangled mess of trees, both standing and fallen, underbrush, you know, stuff that does not work for the British regulars. But for Warner's irregular troops, militia, this is perfect. This is how they should fight. The American line was about a half mile long, and it ran from one elevated section to another. And it anchored itself on the extreme left on a hill called Zion, which was very steep, which would deter British from moving and trying to turn the American flank. And the Americans put up a heck of a fight. The British are fighting almost an invisible enemy because they can't see them or they're hidden very well. And they're very difficult to shoot at because they're behind trees, underbrush, everything. The fact was that the high ground was going to be the linchpin. So Fraser sends his men to turn the flank there, but the Americans counter, and a sharp fight breaks out there. The British are actually on the ropes at this point. They've tried to turn the flanks, but it's not working. Well, lucky for the British, the Brunswickers arrive. Riedesel had heard the fighting, moved his men to support Fraser. So the Americans are getting a fight on two sides now. The Germans have arrived. The British are fully invested in the fight. So it's starting to look like that the Americans are going to have to pull back. Sinclair hears that the fighting is going on in Hubbardton and ordered two militia regiments to move to support Warner to help them get out of there. But, of course, their militia And they say, well, heck with that. And they beat Feet to Castleton, which was going to be the end point for Sinclair and his army. Riedesel had ordered his regiment to move forward and ordered his Jaegers and Grenadiers ahead in the lightning attack, something that Germans are apparently known for, to break through the Massachusetts line. The Massachusetts men hold. They're holding strong until Colonel Francis is killed. Once that happens, the Massachusetts men scatter. Warner, not being able to hold on with just his 150 men, orders a retreat. And I will say he's quoted as having one of the greatest retreat lines ever. He says, "Scatter men and meet me in Manchester." The fight was a short, bloody battle in the woods that lasted only about 40 minutes. In that time, 15 officers and 183 soldiers are killed or wounded. For the Americans, they lose 12 officers and 312 soldiers killed, wounded, or captured. So, it's a sharp fight, but it's definitely one for of note in this early part of the Saratoga campaign. So Seth Warner's men evaporate, the Massachusetts, New Hampshire men, they head off, they break off, and they retreat. Sinclair is on his way to Skenesborough. He is going to get to Skenesborough, and then he's going to continue on to Castleton, realizing that the British are close. But that 40-minute battle gave him some more time. Time is everything. But we're going to see that that's not the only time that the British are going to be delayed. Because while all of this is going on, the American fleet was taking an easy trip down the lake to Skenesborough. See, Colonel Long, who was in command of the fleet, thought that the British were going to be at least a day behind him because they had set up that fantastic boon and chain system and the bridges and floating piers and everything that they had at Ticonderoga would deter him. Or at least slow them down. Well, the British gunboats actually made quick work of the chain, a couple of well-placed cannon shots, and the chain and boom system was broken apart and the chain sank to the bottom of the river. As for the floating piers and bridges, well, that wasn't easy to get rid of either. So the whole defense that Long has believed that is going to keep the British fleet away has completely failed. And so when he arrives in Skenesborough, they're only an hour behind. Sinclair is on his way towards Castleton, where he's eventually going to make his way to Fort Edward. And Long now has the invalids, artillery, and supplies that he's going to keep sending down the river. He's going to take his whatever men he has that are available to fight, burn Skenesborough, march overland to Fort Anne. Burgoyne, only about an hour behind Long, stops about 3 miles north of Skenesborough. He drops off three regiments of men. Their job was simple. Block the road to Fort Anne. Go through the woods, cut off the road to Fort Anne. It's the most direct route. Then the Americans at Skenesborough would be trapped between our fleet when it arrives and you guys when you get to the road, when they get to that point on the road. So he drops the men off and then heads for Skenesborough. He arrives at Skenesborough just in time to see Long pretty much setting fire to the last building and marching his men out of there. The British disembark and are now going to give chase. He decides that he's going to send the 9th Regiment of Foot under Colonel Hill after them. But there's a problem. See, Burgoyne knew that there were three regiments heading to block the road, so he didn't send the 9th right away. He waited for the next morning, assuming that the British regiments would have them trapped and then the Americans would be forced to, you know, get enveloped by the 9th when it arrives on the scene and, you know, they would be stuck between, well, the four regiments that Burgoyne has now sent to block the road to Fort Anne. Only problem was that the force that he sent to block the Fort Anne road was going through thick forest, and it took him a lot longer than Burgoyne thought to get in position. So by the time they got to the road, the Americans had already bypassed that section, and so the Americans were past the three regiments on their way to Fort Anne. When the 9th gets there, Colonel Hill decides that he is going to wait it out, and then he marches them an additional 10 or so miles to the fort, or at least within a mile of the fort, and then he's going to wait them out. He's going to see what happens and see what he can do. Well, in that short waiting game, a deserter, I'm using air quotes, arrives at the British camp, tells Hill, well, if you're planning to lay siege at the fort, that's going to be difficult. There's over 1,000 men stationed at the fort. You're going to need a sizable force. Hill, taking this deserter at his word, says, well, he may have thought, well, maybe he's, flexing the number. Maybe, it might not be 1,000, but we do know that the American force, and I should air quote that one too, the American force in and around Ticonderoga was estimated at somewhere around 10,000 men, even though it was like one-fifth that. It wouldn't be surprising that there would be 1,000 men at Fort Anne. So he sends word to Burgoyne. He says, hey, I got 1,000 men here at Fort Anne. I need support. Send me some troops. We are awaiting Burgoyne's response. Hill had 190 men, so he wasn't going to be able to take on such a sizable force. Well, then sometime in the night, that deserter, air quotes, slipped away, goes back to the fort, and tells Long of the situation for the British. Well, Long decides that he's not going to wait for reinforcements to arrive. He's going to take advantage of this. He had 400 fresh militia. Reinforcements under the command of Colonel Henry Van Rensselaer. In the thick woods, this would be great for New York woodsmen because this was New York militia. The Van Rensselaer family is a very prominent family in New York at this time period. If anyone is once again reading along, you're going to see the name as Van Rensselaer, as a lot of people pronounce it. Trust me, having worked at Saratoga National Historical Park, and this, a lot of the pronunciation I'm giving you is correct. It is Van Rensselaer. He is a part of a well-known family and a relative, I'm not sure the relation exactly, but a relative of Colonel Philip Schuyler on Philip Schuyler's wife's side. In the thick woods, there was going to be no proper battle. The British hear the Americans coming, but they have no idea where the attack is coming from. The Americans are wearing their hunting frocks and they're fighting behind trees. They're doing their backwoodsman-y thing and they're practically invisible to the British. And they open up an attack. Hill tries to rally his men the best that he could, but they were outnumbered, outmatched, and outgunned. He held as long as he could, but when ammunition became critical, he had to think about possible surrender. Until he hears a sound that caused him great relief. It was a war whoop. And a war whoop for the Americans meant that reinforcements had arrived and they had Indians. Now these backwoodsmen were not, some of them were at least attuned to fighting with Indians, but they don't know how large the British force is and they don't want to scrap with Indians if there's a sizable British force coming. So after about a half hour or so of fighting, the Americans pull back, retreat from Fort Anne, and then take this very roundabout way to Fort Edward. Sinclair, who finally got himself to Castleton after bypassing Skanesboro, hears about Hubbardton and what's going on at Skanesboro, and understand that these losses are going to hurt, and he has one option. He's got to get his men to Fort Edward. Him, also taking a very roundabout route through the woods, arrives there 6 days later on June 12th, unmolested. So the American army now is consolidated at Fort Edward, along with their supplies, artillery, and everything. And now they're going to start seeking a new position. This is where all the confusion that we've gone through these past couple episodes is now starting to, it's starting to come together. We're going to move away from the following the American army, and we are going to talk about another American force, not part of the Army of the Northern Department, when we talk about the Battle of Bennington, which is going to happen next week. Battle of Bennington is going to be one of the four turning points of the American Revolution. Like I said, there are four things that they say are the turning points of the American Revolution. Three of them happen on this campaign, and Bennington is the first. And I will definitely point out them as we go along. But as for that, we are done with this episode for the week. I want to thank everyone for their patience and their understanding. It is a double header week. I'm posting, it's almost a triple header. I'm posting episodes rapid fire because I want to get back on track. And I really would like to do an episode on Memorial Day, which will be the Battle of Bennington, kind of as a tribute episode to, you know, everyone that we remember on Memorial Day. And for this Memorial Day, we are going to remember the troops that fought and died at the Battle of Bennington in Vermont. Until then, everyone have a great weekend, enjoy the barbecues, and as always, keep the powder dry.